Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Christian Muntin. Christian is an advisor to owners, executives, and boards. As the founder of Vantage Consulting, Christian has empowered owners and executives of small and medium-sized businesses to boost their top-line revenues by over $500 million. In this episode, Christian shares why leadership starts from within, requiring self-awareness and a commitment to personal growth. They explore the foundational role of relationships in leadership, the importance of productive tension in teams, and discuss that leaders create the conditions for breakthrough moments. From navigating conflict to shaping workplace culture, Christian offers insights on how leadership development is an ongoing process, one that requires curiosity and the right support system. Whether you're leading in crisis or simply looking to refine your approach, this conversation is packed with actionable takeaways to help you and your team grow. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined by Christian Muntin out of Anchorage, Alaska. I think my first guest from Anchorage. So there you go. Christian's the author of Trained to Lead. He's also an advisor and consultant with Vantage Consulting. And it's going to be a fun conversation today. So welcome to the show, Christian.
Yeah, thank you, Dane. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about you. How did you come to be writing the book and doing all this really cool work with leaders and teams?
Yeah, well, I'll answer the second part first. I got involved in working with leaders and teams 20 plus years ago. I was involved in international disaster relief and community development. So I was working in places around Africa and the Balkans and Indonesia and Middle East mm-hmm. and Latin America. And I just started to see that you could be in pretty secure environments and very well-funded or even overfunded projects. And if you were not led well or the team didn't get along well, the projects were just miserable and it was very hard to be productive and to produce value for the communities that we were in. On the other hand, I saw that we could be in an active conflict or war zone and have not really anywhere near the resources we needed. But if we were led well and our team got along well, then it was really pretty amazing, the morale and what we could produce for the community. So I became fascinated with that dynamic. And I saw that also with the community partners that, you know, whether it was a war where it seems more obvious or a natural disaster where sometimes it seems less obvious, ultimately the size of the problem or whether it became a chronic long-running issue or how well or how fast it was resolved had everything to do with leadership. That always came down to leadership. And so I thought, I want to learn more about this, and I'm fascinated about it. Along with it, we would learn tools for entering communities quickly, finding out who the key influencers were in the community, who needed to be involved, how to design plans for the community or with the community. And I began to think, wow, organizations are like, I thought I discovered something. I thought organizations are like little communities. Maybe I could bring these tools into organizations. And I discovered someone else had already discovered that, organizational development and consulting, before I did. But that's how I got into it. I kind of came into it sideways, just through personal interest and seeing the impact of both good and inadequate leadership or just poor leadership.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah,
I've had some similar experiences in my life in mining communities, oil and gas project environments where we're building, you know, particularly in greenfield environments where there isn't a lot of infrastructure. You've got a community that's not used to big industry being on their doorstep.
Right.
And it's always, to your point, it's always proven fascinating when you see what teams can do from very little and just how they rally, not just the individual team. You even mentioned it with community partners, how they build this kind of ecosystem of teams. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is neat. When it's all working really well, it's really one of the neatest experiences, I think.
Yeah. What was it early in life that took you in that direction? Was it coming out of military, or what put you in those locations?
No. I was actually originally interested in ministry.
Yeah.
And I was involved in that space, and I was working in the Middle East, actually. And it was the first time I was exposed to disaster relief work. And and I thought, it just, something clicked in me, and I thought, that's what I want to do. Or at least that's how I want to express this, you know, part of myself. And so I pursued that and started doing that for a while. Then that led to leadership and teams, which I think is, that's ultimately, I think, if you want to use the language, my calling, like that's where I've spent the last 20 years.
Yeah, brilliant. There's something about disasters. I mean, we've seen it recently. In fact, I think I saw you post on the LA fires. We've seen it around hurricanes down in the Gulf where people just come together and connect and just get things done.
They can.
Yeah.
And it's usually for a window of time, typically, you know, weeks or a couple of months. And then you really need, I mean, you can get sort of this organic community surrounding and helping each other.
Yeah.
But then this is not a cynical thing. It's just human behavior. People get tired. They get stressed. They start to wonder, is this ever going to end?
Yeah.
The truth is, for any of these things, for North Carolina, for some of the stuff in Florida, for LA, the rebuilding takes years. And so most everybody's already forgotten about North Carolina and we're moving on to LA now. LA will, because they're good at kind of self-promotion, they'll stay in the headlines more. But eventually people are going to move on to the next thing. But the rebuilding is going to take years. And for some people, they'll never be able to rebuild, you know. And so it's that kind of stresses, frustrations, when the answers don't come as fast or the way you thought they would. That's where that world can get very complicated. And then you'd shove a bunch of money and attention at it, and like all sorts of really interesting scenarios emerge.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And it's that point that you touched on that, you know, you can be in a very stable environment with tons of resources and not have much success. And then you can be in an unstable environment with limited resources and have plenty of success. When you've been in those environments and as you've crafted it into your profession and the book, what are those, you know, key elements of leadership that help you make the best of a tough situation?
Well, I think, and this is where I start the book, and the book actually doesn't reverse so much to the disaster background, but it's more of my athletic background. But the first half of the book references, and this is where I think it starts, it begins with the person of the leader. I think you lead out of who you are. Mm. I think especially over the long term, you know, you can kind of put your game face on and have the persona of a leader that you can maintain for a while. But when you're working in close proximity to people over time, who you really are will come to the top. And if who you really are is not someone who is really clear on your vision, clear on your sense of purpose, clear on your values, if there's rough edges or toxic elements to your personality or your approach or how you do things, that's going to come out.
Yep.
And so I would say at the very beginning, and this maybe feels maybe abstract or kind of, I don't know, fluffy bunny to some people. But the reality is you lead out of who you are. All leadership takes place in the context of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that leaders have an obligation to do personal development, to work on themselves.
Yeah.
And they have an obligation to learn how to handle relationships well.
Yes.
And if you could do both of those things, it's very easy to understand how to do strategic planning or how to run team meetings or how to find somebody else who can interpret your financials if you don't know how to do that. You know, there's all of those other skills are much easier to resolve. If you're operating out of anxiety or if you're operating out of other deeper issues that are kind of common in leaders, that's hard to work with. And those are the things that bring leaders down.
Yeah. No, I've definitely seen it, experienced it myself. I think it's one of the things that always fascinated me about the topic of teamwork, and that you can actually have a great leader and a great team, and then at some point in time, one dynamic changes and then everything can crumble. And I think what you touched on there, like that threat chemistry, like operating from fear and anxiety, is what really starts to set in a lot of fragility in teams.
And it's interesting because I think many people look at leaders and assume that there's a mentor of mine years ago was talking to me, and he's like, you know, and he's a pretty well-known guy in a particular area. And he's like, you know, Christian, everyone thinks I've got it all together. If they really knew what it was like behind the scenes, you know, and how they were just kind of, some things were just being duct taped together and held together, but it was mostly working most of the time, and yeah. And people liked it, so they just assumed everything was perfect. And I think a lot of leaders, you know, one of the most common challenges for leaders, and people hear about this, is the imposter syndrome or the fear of being found out that I don't know how to do it all, or I'm not sure how to handle this situation, or I feel like I'm freezing up, or I'm getting angry and I'm not sure how to handle that. Or
yes.
There's a conflict, or there's an employee that I'm struggling with and it's bringing up emotions that I don't know what to do with, and et cetera, et cetera. And those are when I first got involved in, let's say, the executive coaching side of what I do, I assumed it would be mostly around strategy and helping people navigate particular elements of growing their companies. And they do want to talk about that. But the majority of the time is spent around these dynamics that are informed by how they process life, how they interpret things, how they respond to things. And that's really where the bulk of the work is.
I can see that. We had a guest on the show just recently, Alex Draper. He wrote the book Care to Win. Okay. And your point on relationships, that's the third part of his sort of acronym. So he's got clarity, autonomy, then relationships, and then equity. But, you know, to have those relationships, it really holds everything together above in his structure.
Yeah, it's important.
It's super important. And when I look back on the tough times I've had, either in a team or under a leader that was struggling, or when I've been struggling myself, you can see that's what, to your point, you start seeing these emotions showing up and people don't really know how to talk about it, how to share it, going back to that sort of vulnerability. We've not necessarily seen a lot of leaders modeling the right ways to do that.
Yeah. And you know, most of us, my first book I wrote was called Conflict and Leadership. And it was because that's such a, well, I came out of some of my own personal experience of not handling conflicts well and needing to learn how to do that. But something I point out to a lot of my clients or people that I'm training in that space is, if you actually handle some of these things well, you may be the first person in your employee's life that they've ever seen experience a confrontation and handle it in a way that maintains respect, maintains dignity, but also has healthy boundaries.
Yeah.
And just by watching you do that, even if they don't understand the mechanics of what you did, could transform their life. And it does because they see now, oh, there's another way to do this. And that starts to create, you know, a pathway of hope, which in that can not just change their ability at work. The cool thing about it, and I think the coolest testimonials that I get sometimes, are the change that it makes in people's homes.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing. You're the same human being. And if you're letting this change you personally, if you're letting the pursuit of becoming a more effective leader transform who you are, and you allow that to work on you, I think it can make you a much more robust and healthier person.
Yeah.
If you don't get sucked into the idea of, I need to hide and isolate, not let people see my weakness, not let, you know, and maintain a front, then that you start to hollow out at the core, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right. I had an experience the other day to that end where I was facing a challenging situation, and I shared with my business partners. I said, I'm really struggling to like contain my emotions and think clearly through this. And it was really cool. Again, it's come from working with a good coach to be able to have that confidence to share it. And it's amazing that we think that by sharing that, we're showing weakness. But the very first response that they both had is, tell me a bit more about it. How you experienced it? How might I be able to help? And it's just, it's wonderful. It just creates so much energy to have that raw kind of trusting moment.
Yeah, that's important to have those kinds of relationships. And I don't think that many, I think more leaders do now than used to.
Yeah.
But because there used to be almost a taught idea that you needed to be, you need to project an image of sort of you know, being complete unto yourself.
Yeah.
And I think more people have moved away, but still, I would think that in my experience is that the dominant perspective of when I'm working with executives is that they still feel a need to feel like they're supposed to have all the answers or hold themselves all together. And so, yeah, in terms of teams, you know, you had mentioned the research around it is very clear, and you may be familiar with it. You're probably familiar with it. One of the most powerful tools for building a team is really being able to create that sense of safety where people can talk through issues. And this doesn't mean that it's without challenge or without conflict or confrontation, but it means that those things are embedded in respect for each other and space to actually, a commitment to actually talk it through and to preserve the relationship. And when that exists, people use the word, I think it's Amy Edmondson out of Harvard used the term psychological safety, but so it's not like avoiding triggering people. It's saying if we're triggered or something happens, we're going to work this through.
Yeah.
And committing to a true conclusion or a true being heard and not some kind of a surfacey thing. And when you build that, it actually takes a team of sometimes, I wrote an article about this a little while ago, of maybe B players and transforms it into an A team.
Yeah.
Where you have a high-performing team. Because they can actually solve problems.
Yeah. And what I like about that is that there's a lot of rhetoric out there, particularly amongst the people who like to use the A player as a weapon. And they're like, well, A players are A players. And, you know, they're born that way. And where I actually think that, I don't know whether the landscape of the game's changing, but I actually think to your point, if you can bring in more healthy conflict, if you can bring in healthy team dynamics, then there isn't really such thing as an A player or a B player. There's someone who, I like the word that you use, commits to talk through and work through conflicts and can problem solve. And, you know, they're an A player on any team, regardless of technical skills.
Yeah, and I think it intuitively makes sense that if you pull together a group of A players, then they should perform well. But in practicality, that doesn't always work because A players don't always play together well.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't matter how good you are independently, if you're not playing well, I can't remember if it was the most recent Olympics or the one previous, but the U.S. basketball team in sort of an after reflection was, I can't remember which one because I don't follow basketball that closely, but one of the teams didn't perform that well, even though they were all made up out of like legendary A players.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussion afterwards was, all of these folks have a tendency to sort of be the star on their team or to be a showboater. And when they were forced to all be together and have to work with each other, they hadn't practiced. They hadn't played together. They didn't feel like they needed to. So they blew it.
Yep.
I don't know the specifics around that, but that's what comes to mind is it's easy to do that.
It is. And I actually had a podcast guest and I can't quite land on the name right now, but he talked about that exact Olympic scenario. And he said the following Olympics, they brought in two players that weren't big names, but they were just real like glue in the team. They drove better communications. They connected passes between the key players. They had these roles to play that just elevated the whole team's, gamesmanship and impact.
Yeah. So it's important when you're either constructing a team or if you're given and inherited a team.
Yeah.
Either way, as a leader, the great hope in this, particularly in today's hiring environment for most leaders where you can't always get the ideal on paper employees, is that you have the ability to elevate the performance of the whole by really working on these interrelational dynamics between them.
Yes.
And really, it's this combination of, you know, using like a sports analogy, a good team will do both things of both play really hard but respect and support each other. Like they'll challenge each other, but respect and support each other.
Yep.
I practice Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which is not a team sport, but when you train with each other, you're supporting each other's growth. And to do that well, you have to actually fight the other guy, literally.
Yeah.
But you do it with a way where there's respect and safety. So you're not trying to actually damage the other person. And that supports both of your growth, is if you're able to maintain the appropriate amount of tension while being concerned of the welfare of the other person.
Yeah, I like that analogy a lot. And you've used a couple of times in the conversation today, Christian, you know, dignity, respect, safety. It's really interesting. They're kind of universal core values. If you can create that in a team and you can have that tension, then people aren't going home at the end of the day frustrated about an interaction with a colleague or a boss. Everyone's incrementally getting that 1% better.
Right.
And it just builds both a bond in the team. Certainly we see that in the rugby teams that I coach. You know, they kind of get on each other a bit. Hey, you needed to be in there and make that tackle,
right,
or you've got to run straighter, or you need to pass the ball. But by the end of the game, they're all hugging and they're tight,
yeah,
and, you know,
yeah,
they've done the work together. It's cool.
Yeah, and I think it's important as a coach to try to, you know, you have to watch. You probably see this. If you're in a sport like rugby where there's a lot of physical engagement, you're going to have some people that don't manage it well.
Yeah.
And so being able to observe that and pull that person out and sort of help them refine their place into the team. If two people get into a fight, how do you help them reconcile? And then how do you help the team feel comfortable with them?
Yeah.
So a good leader expects those kinds of things to happen and then will work to really support everyone's success and their ability to work with each other.
Yeah. A good friend of mine, Andre Martin, he talks about in teams, the leader's role is not to create the lightning strikes, it's to create the condition for the lightning strikes to happen. It's super cool. And what you just shared is that, you know, I haven't thought about it in the context that you laid out, but as a leader, if someone has a rough moment, your job is to kind of resettle them, you know, reprogram them back into the team and make sure that the other team are accepting of the learning moment, the growth moment.
Yeah. And it can be profound. I mean, this is something I've not shared this story publicly. I've been practicing jiu-jitsu for a long time, but when I first started, I was training with a guy who I had never met before, and he was very out of control. And jiu-jitsu is not a striking sport,
mm-hmm,
but he kicked me in the head 4 times.
Oof.
And so just the fact that happened, kind of, you could tell things were out of control. I lost it and punched him at the last time he kicked me.
Yeah.
And I felt immediately, you know, awful that I lost control and felt bad about it and apologized. He was running around screaming and yelling at me. And I had to go through this process of regaining trust with people in the gym because they were still getting to know me too.
Yes.
And so, but what was interesting is I talked to the head instructor because I felt awful. I thought I might get kicked out of the gym and all these things. So I talked to him and I said, here's what happened. You know, I didn't try to absolve myself of anything. I just said, here's the scenario. And he said, now you know what it feels like. Now you know what that anger feels like and what that emotion feels like. So now when you start to feel that coming up, you know that you need to step away.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought that was so helpful for me. And I never have forgotten that lesson. When I start to notice the emotions showing up, it's like, oh, I need to make an alternative decision now and not wait for things to get worse.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting going back to you said it earlier here, you said lead out of who you are. That's what it was. You lead out of who you are. What's interesting with ego, and I've been in some of those situations and misbehaved. And I find what's interesting with ego is that, you know, you've got your own values and principles. And if you feel like someone's encroaching upon those and you get triggered and you don't get out of that situation, that's when the bad stuff happens. And
and
it actually compounds because all of a sudden you break all of your own values because you're acting out of that like fight or flight mode.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
is an interesting observation, and it's true that everybody in those scenarios wants to feel morally justified in what they're doing. And so we come up with these just kind of incredible gymnastics and our rationalizations for that. But oftentimes you're right. We end up breaking our own values in the process of defending our values. And and I think it does take humility to acknowledge that and work on it. And so as it relates to leadership and teams, I think that when a leader is willing to do that work themselves, and even when they blow it or they make a mistake they're able to work on, creating restoration and working on things. It demonstrates to people that there's another way to handle situations, as we mentioned earlier. But I think it also, there's appropriateness in how much you share, but I think a leader who is clearly working on growing shows people that you can work on growth. And I could tell when I work with companies, even large companies, if I meet enough frontline employees, I can tell you about the executive team.
Interesting.
Because there's just commonalities that are going to show up culturally that are, they just will be reflections of elements of what you'll find when you're at senior leadership. And I've experienced that enough times that I've just realized that can become part of my, if for whatever reason I'm not entering in from meeting the senior leaders first.
Yeah.
I know that if I meet enough front-facing employees from enough kind of departments, the similarities between them are almost always typical of what you're going to find at the senior leadership role. So, for example, if I'm working with employees and their teams are struggling with avoidance of conflict and a tendency to not provide accountability, which is a common kind of a two that go together, there may be 12 layers of management above them, but when you get to that top level of management, it's almost guaranteed you're going to find avoidance of conflict and issues with accountability.
Interesting.
And I just say that, I bring that up to say that that's personal work.
Yes.
And if that leader isn't aware of that, the ripple effect is significant.
And that's a tricky one too, because, I actually had another guest on a show earlier today and we were talking about courage in the workplace. Often if you've got a leader that is struggling with, that conflict avoidance or accountability, to call the leader out is really scary stuff. But that leader may have a blind spot there. They probably know if you tell them that it's true, but they're not thinking that that's the problem today. They're thinking it's something else.
Right. Yeah, it's in my work, there's a lot of trust building that I usually do with somebody before they even hire me. But whatever the thing is that needs to be done to help somebody out, ultimately the individual leader, all of us, and even for myself as a consultant and a coach, I have to commit to, I have to keep working on myself. Like I can't.
Yeah.
In fact, I found that all of the best coaches, and I work with some of the really high-level coaches around the world, or I connect with them socially, and all of the best ones have their own coaches. They have their own or counselors or somebody, but they've recognized that if they're not working on themselves, even good counselors, my wife's a counselor, and good counselors have their own counselors, that they're just kind of realize that you have to keep doing your own work.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it. I've more recently come to coaching and therapy as well, and I find them to be two very different things, but to have complementary elements.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like whenever I think I'm done here, because I'm pretty good at firing coaches, a little bit hard-headed maybe, I kind of like, I'm done here. I've learned what I need to learn. I know what I'm going to go and do. And then it doesn't take much longer before you realize, oh, I've fallen back into that, or I haven't been applying this.
Right.
So it's not something that you just kind of learn and you're like, okay, I'm now a master. It's a constant pursuit.
When I work with clients, at least with the method of coaching that I use, I find that it usually takes a client the first couple of months to just settle and start actually doing the things. Usually around 4 to 6 months in, we start to see results.
Yep.
And that's where a lot of them are like, okay, we're seeing the results. I'm done. And you feel that. But I encourage people to stick around at least for another 6 months.
Yeah.
Because of the habituation. Like we need to somehow make this part of who you are, because I know at some point they're going to have learned these new habits, these new practices, these new perspectives, but we haven't hit a major stressor yet. And when that major stressor comes, that stuff tends to go away and they fall back on the more ingrained behaviors or belief systems.
Yep.
And if I can be there to walk them through that, then there's a higher chance that we'll help habituate that and sync that into how they operate and make that more of a default approach, like these new, healthier approaches.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty predictable sort of a cycle or a process that people will learn something, they'll feel a relief from whatever the issue was.
Yep.
And they'll think this is cognitive. It's like, it's not cognitive. This is a very, very deep psychological kind of a dynamic that's actually happening, depending on what we're working on. I mean, for some people, it is cognitive. There's just like, how do I handle the situation? That's what you're working on. But
yeah,
for most people, if you're dealing with, you know, topics around, you know, why is it that they feel like they need to dominate every conversation, mm-hmm, or whatever the thing is. And that's a pretty deep issue, or stress, or something, time management, priority management issues. It's very common to have these little relapses, or whatever language you want to use.
And, yeah, it feels like a relapse whenever I go through it.
Yeah, and we, everybody will.
Yeah.
Because nobody gets everything perfect immediately. It's really just this commitment to like recognize it quickly and then get back to what you know works as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And if you need support, go get the support. And as you know, we both discussed earlier, anybody who's good at what they're doing in this space, any good athlete will have support.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, one of my coaches recently talked about it like a pit crew. He's like, if you're racing a vehicle, you can't just be running it hot around the track constantly. You need to bring it in every now and again. And then you can't be the guy who gets out and starts working on your own car. You know?
Right.
So it's like you really need to build that crew and make sure that you've all got a process.
Yeah.
I like that analogy. And it actually leads me to another question for you, Christian, which is when you're working with these leaders and teams, how much of your work do you find is working with the leader versus working with a group of leaders or even an intact team?
It's maybe 50-50,
yep,
roughly. Yeah. So and sometimes it's both. Sometimes I'm working with the leader and then the team, both. Mm-hmm. Or I'm just doing executive coaching with the client, or I'm working with their whole team. So it kind of depends on what I'm doing specifically.
When you work with that team or that group of leaders, how much do you start building some of your coaching practice and mindset into actual like routine meetings, or, you know, here's our charter for how we handle conflict? Do you ever sort of turn it into artifacts in the business? For example, I was working with a coach recently and we created this way of having our conversation. And so once I was coached on it, I then went and coached my team on, hey, this is how we're going to have tough conversations around issues to create some, you know, awareness before we try and dive into solving and seeing who's right.
Yeah. I would say maybe 2/3 of the time I do something like that.
Yeah.
So it depends on the team. A lot of my work is custom, so it kind of depends on what we're going to be working on. But what I am trying to do when I work with clients is to improve their ability to do something. And because when I'm working with my clients, they typically grow as a result of it. So I want to be able to move on to work with them with these new things.
Yes.
And not still have to be doing the basic stuff. And so, for example, a real classic thing that I'll do with clients is help them develop a strategic plan and then meet with them regularly to help them implement the plan.
Yep.
And part of that process, and it's just implementing and accountability, but I've learned along the way that I'll be able to watch how they work together.
Yeah.
Then that'll give me an opportunity to coach them on their team dynamics and leadership.
Yep.
In that way, I teach them certain processes. Sometimes it's very overt, like I just teach it to them, like, here's what I'm doing.
Yep.
And here's how you can replicate it. Other times it's just embedded in the system, but I'm teaching them new ways of looking at things or new ways of perceiving or new ways of relating that help them more constructively kind of move ahead on their own. And so outgrow their need for me to be present in that area or in that context.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What I've seen with a lot of leaders often when they're getting coached is where their biggest breakthrough is just bringing curiosity to the conversation. You know, a team member's failed to achieve what they're accountable to achieve, and they don't march in and say, where's that report? It was due yesterday. They come in and say, hey, Bob, hey, Jenny, how are you going? You know, tell me a little bit more about, you know, what's happening for you this week, and it's not like you to have missed this. You know, I'm worried about you. And they just take a very different approach in, and they kind of go in feelings first. Is that something you see more of?
I don't know that I see more of it. I mean, it depends on different clients. Like I have, yeah. I have a lot of, it's interesting. And I'm trying to see if this is true or not. It feels like it is, but it may not be. I have about half of my clients are in construction.
Yeah.
But it seems like many of them are actually very, many of the presidents that I'm working with are very people aware. And maybe that's partially who I attract.
Interesting. But
I would say for many of them, the challenge is how do you appropriately hold others to account is a bigger challenge than just being curious. Now, the curiosity thing, I'm thinking about one president that I was working with. It was a larger company, and he started commenting on how often I asked him, like, well, did you go ask him about that?
Yeah.
Because he would be bringing a scenario to me. He's like, I don't know why they're doing this. I was like, well, why don't you just go ask them? Instead of us sitting here coming up with scenarios, trying to read their mind.
Yeah.
Just go ask them and get an answer and be done with it.
Yeah.
And what I find is that simple thing on its own, I mean, there's a takeaway for somebody, I'm sure, is like get out of your own head and stop trying to figure out what's going on and just go ask.
Mm-hmm.
Just that on its own will resolve a significant amount of conflict because we create these just amazing stories in our heads that are almost always negative about what's happening. And if you just go ask, like, hey, when you walked in the room the other day, you didn't say hi and I tried to get your attention and you just went straight to your office and I just, like, are you okay or what's going on? Do we need to talk about something? That on its own just saves all sorts of problems, makes the next meeting go better, everything else. You know, maybe there is something that needs to be talked about. Maybe they just were unfocused. You know, who knows what was going on? But there's a tendency to just jump to conclusions and then start reacting out of conclusions. And that is consistently dangerous.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Totally agree. And particularly in a construction environment where you've got, you know, a lot of different people, different tasks, hazardous equipment. Oh, yeah. You know, you got to be really careful out there.
Well, and in any environment, yeah. But when you have more safety issues involved, the other big chunk of my clients are usually in health, so medical clinics or hospitals or something like that. And same thing. It's, you know, I was working with, you talk about teams. I was working with, or somebody called me, a hospital called, and they said, we got issues with our ER doc and nurse, a couple of nurses. And I just said, well, who cares? I mean, like, why? I'm going to ask you to invest a lot of money and time into fixing this.
Yeah.
Why bother? Like, is it that big of a deal?
Uh-huh.
And what I was trying to get is commitment beforehand. Like, is this actually important enough to work on and invest in? And she said, well, you know, it impacts patient outcomes. So I was like, okay, just so I understand, are patient outcomes like morbidity and mortality? And she's like, yeah. I said, okay, just so I understand. You're saying patients are more likely to die or get sick in your hospital because of the way these three people relate to each other.
And
she's like, well, yeah, I guess so. I said, okay, let's set the ethics of that aside. What risk exposure does this give you? You know, what liability do you have here? I mean, I got that contract and we addressed the issues, you know, but we needed to get past a lot of the euphemisms around. We just want the team to be better because who cares unless there's an outcome that we're going to change.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about patient outcomes. It's like, well, what does that really mean? We're talking about sickness and death.
Uh-huh.
And then you realize like, oh, the way this doc and these nurses were talking to each other or not talking was actually causing people to die or get sick while they were there. And that's a big, big deal. That's important. Yep. And it's beyond the weight we would normally put on having healthy team dynamics. That sounds the fluffy bunny HR type thing.
Yeah.
It's like, no, actually, this is literally life and death that we're talking about in that context. And so you guys do need to get your stuff together. Like, you need to figure this out or you don't belong here.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it comes down to things like that.
That's a really powerful story, Christian. I particularly like the who cares, because at first it feels a little bit like abrasive, adversarial, but it gets you right to the heart of what's really happening here. And I like the way you tied it to commitment too.
Yeah, because I don't say that to most people that call me, but sometimes I do. And it's when I pick up on the sense of we're going to have to do real work here and it's going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And if we don't have real commitment to this, and if the initial presenting problem, like team dynamics, doesn't seem weighty enough to actually carry people through to a solution, we need to figure out what actually makes this important. And in that case, it became a very dramatic kind of a conclusion to that conversation.
Yeah.
But where these issues or the friction points emerge, they're irritating, but sometimes we feel like, well, I can live with that, you know, as opposed to really making the investments to fix it. And the investments may not necessarily be hiring a coach or something like that.
Sure.
Or a consultant, but but that's going to require change of some kind.
Yeah.
And are we really willing to invest in doing things differently and seeing somebody differently or relating differently? And if we're not, I'm not going to do a dog and pony show for somebody.
Yeah.
And so, find somebody else for that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's key. We've covered some really cool stuff from, resources don't drive projects. It's the leadership of the team.
Right.
I love that leading out of who you are and how relationship with self and others is so critical. It's core to coaching. I particularly like the way you shared that, you may be the first person that's modeling this behavior to an employee that can, have impacts at home in their community. That's really cool. And you use the word pathway of hope, which I thought is cool because it's just very human. I think every team needs it.
Right.
So we talked a lot through there, and particularly the comments around like reframing the A players, having the tension in the team, creating the work, being problem solvers. There's just so much good stuff. I can see why it plays so well in particularly construction and healthcare environments. I guess my final question for you, Christian, having come through all of that, is like, how does that all shape into the book? Like, what was it that made you think, well, I'm going to write this book, Train to Lead? And, what should our listeners
be
sort of drawn to there?
Well, what came up on there, so I have a background in athletics, and for about 12 years, I was a strength and conditioning instructor.
Yeah.
And so one day I was driving away from the gym, and I thought, why is it that I can take an athlete, and they can be 3 months away from their event, whatever they're trying to do, and I can design a training program for them that will have them peak out the day of the event,
that
will be at the best they possibly can be? And why is it for leaders, we don't have anything like that? Leadership, I think, is arguably probably more important than athletic performance, as much as I love athletics.
Yeah.
But most leadership development is something along the lines of, here's a good book. Maybe we'll send you to a conference or a workshop. Now don't screw up.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work that well. And I thought, well, what if we were to apply the basic, because there's a framework or a set of principles that most trainers that work with elite athletes use. It's called a periodization approach to training. And basically it walks people through, growing in your nutrition and growing in your basic conditioning, your ability to handle stress, then focusing on strength for a while, focusing on plyometrics or power for a while, then focusing on endurance, then focusing on recovery, and then cycling back through. And the idea is you grow a little bit in each area, you improve a little bit in each area, and then you move on. And that seems to be generating the best results for the most athletes kind of across the board, is an approach that's based like that. That's what most trainers are using. And so I started looking at the parallels, what would be nutrition for leaders? Like, that's the influences that I allow into myself. And how do I make sure that I'm curating those? When it comes to conditioning and adapting myself to be able to manage stress and to manage myself well, how do I set myself up to be able to handle complicated or demanding situations? What are the core leadership strengths that any leader would need to have to be able to move people together in a particular direction?
Yeah.
Power, the way I define power is not power over people, but it's the ability to move in a way that generates momentum or changes the direction of something. That's the physics definition of power, and it comes from athletics too. And so looking at change, conflict, and crisis issues, how do you exercise the strengths quickly enough and forcefully enough in these contexts where power, the ability to create momentum or change is necessary or change direction? Then looking at endurance, how do you maintain leadership over the long haul? How do you put structures in place? How do you take care of yourself so that you can keep leading well for as long as you're staying in those leadership roles over the long period of time?
Yeah.
Because you do see a difference in leaders that are new to leadership trying to lead, as opposed to someone who's owned a company for 15, 20 years and there's a different set of challenges that emerges for yes. somebody who's been in a place for a while. And then what does recovery look like? How do you renew yourself? How do you refresh yourself? And so I wrote the book in part because I wanted to there's a concept in athletics or nutrition called bioavailability. And so you yeah. can take certain supplements, and some of them your body absorbs very well and uses them, and others just pass straight through. They're just really expensive, you know, things yeah. that you drink or something. And I felt like most leadership content out there's a lot of great stuff,
just but
a lot of it's not very bioavailable.
Yeah,
and I wanted to create a structure where, whether it's an experienced leader or new leader, they could figure out, how do I begin bringing in these concepts and they stick? Like they actually produce change in me. And so I needed to make it simple enough, but practical enough that people could walk through these different concepts and see how they stack on each other, because they don't. A lot of leaders get interested in strategy or in ownership or in casting vision for their team, but they don't have the basics of self-management down. Like they don't know how to set their own priorities. They don't know how to complete things that they start. And if you're not good at that, then you're ultimately not going to be effective at the other things.
Yeah.
And so I laid it out that way. I tried to write it as if somebody were to buy a really good training manual for a sport. So there's three different workout plans in it, for beginning, one for beginning leaders, for intermediate leaders, and experienced leaders.
Yep.
And it just kind of shows them how to use each of the concepts in the book. Has a specific exercise that goes with it, like a leadership exercise.
Yep.
And it just shows them how to work their way through the exercises over a period of time so that their leadership will improve. And the thing in the book, it's structured around 90 days, but the idea is ongoing personal growth and development.
That's neat, because I think that's what I saw in your LinkedIn profile, 90-day path to leadership excellence. Yeah. And you had the strength and endurance. Yeah. And I did learn, which I was sharing with you before the show, this whole periodization. I need to go and research on that, because if I'm ever going to get back on the rugby field, I've got a lot of strength and endurance.
Yeah, it's very helpful. And it's helpful if you're training your teams at all, you know, if you're coaching. It's a helpful way of structuring a training program that tends to yield better results.
That's super cool. Well, I'll definitely be diving into the book. I love the way that it kind of builds leadership and teamwork into workouts and events. Because you're right, sometimes work can just feel like never ending. But if you can set workouts and events, then it feels like you can actually create the time for that recovery or for those, you know, interim workouts to get there and be ready.
Yeah. And I think part of it too, like when I was teaching classes and working with people, there's an element when you're trying to work on yourself and you're trying to embedder yourself, there's points where it gets boring.
Yeah.
Well, you've read all the books, you're doing all the things, and it just kind of, you get tired.
Yeah.
And so there needs to be a little bit of variation, because your body responds to that stimulus. You tend to find homeostasis in whatever you're doing consistently.
Yes.
So you need a little bit of variation. If you have too much variation, all you're doing in athletics is burning calories. You're not actually cultivating skill. So you need to stick with something for a little while, but then you need to get an adaptation and you move on to the next thing. And you have this cycle with it. And it just helps, I think, it's a healthier approach or more sustainable approach to long-term growth and development, right? So we're right now talking at the end of January.
Yeah.
And so everybody's that built a New Year's resolution, it's probably still around, but it's going to be gone in a month and a half. They're all going to disappear. When I was at the gym all the time, this is super busy time of year. Everyone's got their new Christmas gear that they got, and you know they're ready to finally.
And then they're blown by the time the weather
turns. By March or April, they're gone. And part of what it is you need to have most people do better when there's a structure that they follow.
Yeah.
And structures work better when they're interesting, and they're producing results. And so I just find that for leadership. Because what tends to happen for many leaders is they will fixate on a particular topic that resonates with them, like ownership. That's my big thing.
Yeah.
Listen to Jocko Willink. Jocko Willink's awesome. Love his book on ownership. It literally is a very good book. It's I recommend it. But ownership is only part of it, right? There's more that you need to know. And I'm sure he would say the same thing. I don't think I'm in disagreeing with him. But a lot of people will just pick on everybody needs to take ownership.
And they just go all in.
That's like the one drum that they bang. And it's like there's a lot more to building a team or to leading well than just having one concept down.
Yeah.
And so you need to be able to move on, like grow in your ownership or your ability to get your team to take ownership and then move on to something else. You could come back to ownership again in a while.
Yeah.
But this shouldn't be the one thing you do only.
That's a cool example. And I love the way you use the word there, burning calories versus cultivating skill, because I think to your point, a lot of leaders, a lot of HR departments kind of just fire out so much development material and
right.
everyone's just like overwhelmed. It's just like raining development.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, I'm not getting that time to really cultivate my skill, my craft, you know how my work fits in with someone else's work.
Yeah.
So I think
absolutely.
That's a cool analogy.
And that's an important thing, I think, for there was a couple of federal agencies that had me do leadership development for them, and they were very adamant that we were going to do 3 1-week-long sessions, 8 hours a day.
Yep.
They needed to have butts in seats for 8 hours every day. And I said, could we break this up over, you know, do half days every other week for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months? Like, nope, we need to do it exactly this way. I was like, we can, and I'll do it for you, but you just need to be aware that anything we teach at the beginning of the week is going to be lost halfway through.
Yeah.
They're only going to really remember
cognitive
a little
overload.
Bit of the last day. You just can't absorb it.
Yeah.
And they're like, we're going to do it. This is the way we're doing it. And I was like, all right, as long as you heard me say, you're going to get less value out of this.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, they didn't really want to hear that. But I was like, I put it on record. So I don't advise that. You just can't absorb it.
No, I agree. And a lot of folks, I guess they're forced to do it. They want to show that they're investing in their people or box tick to say to the board, we did our development. But, you know, your people don't take the energy from it or the value from it. So that's why, again, I just
love
that
cultivating. And you have a counter effect with that too, where people, if it's run well and it's a good teacher or whatever, it'll be interesting. But a lot of people recognize we're not getting anything out of this. Or we did this last year and there ultimately were no changes. There were no outcomes.
Yeah.
We're not sufficient for the time that we lost getting work done. And all that work we had to make up when we came back.
Yeah.
And so they're feeling stress about it and all of these things. And so I think it's important that when you do leadership development initiatives, that you are tracking outcomes, that's a really important topic. Most leadership development programs fail, period.
Yeah.
And the reason, in part, is because they've never defined what outcomes do we expect. So if I invest in a coach for an executive, how do we expect that executive to grow as a result of this investment?
Yep.
And there's rarely ever a definition or a way of actually measuring that. And as a result, we do these training programs, we do mass coaching or mass mentoring programs or whatever the thing is, and we never know what goal we're trying to get better at. We never really know. So we don't even know, are the inputs actually matched up to the outcomes? Like, are we doing the right kind of training for what we're trying to produce? And what I found when I work with people around that question, they get resistant to answering it. Like thinking through what do we really want this to produce is a hard question to answer. And people prefer to avoid it. But if you're in a position of bringing these kinds of resources in, you'll do yourself and everybody just a life transforming favor, as well as an organization transforming favor by deciding what is it that we're trying to change here or improve. And how do we know if that happened? And then what's the right input to make that happen?
I think it seems
obvious when you say it, but the thinking process is up to it is we just need to have leadership development. Let's all send them to this program because that sounds cool.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, changing growth is uncomfortable for many people. And a lot of people benefit from the existing systems. You know, there's a lot of leaders who benefit from putting everyone through the Emerging Leaders Program, which doesn't result in outcomes because they're not getting pressured from below. And, you know, there is a sadly, there is a human side to this, you know, around hoarding power and control in organizations too.
Right. Yeah. And that, I guess that's a whole other
conversation. If I didn't have to run down the road to rugby practice now, we could have just started our second episode, but we'll do it again. Yeah. We'll do it again.
Sounds good.
It's been wonderful having you today, Christian. If any of our listeners want to find you at Vantage Consulting or find the book, Train to Lead, where do they go seeking?
Best way to reach me is on my website, christianmuntean.com. Yep. And there's tons of free resources there. And I put out a weekly article on leadership. So if you want to get connected to any of that, you can find it on my website. The book, Train to Lead, and my other books, they're all available on Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or really anywhere that you buy books online.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to a future conversation and some opportunities to team up. It's been great today.
Yeah, it was a great conversation, Dane. Thank you.
Thanks, Christian.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,